On March 7th, 2012, two men, both without gods, met in a Chelsea cafe to discuss a novel about gods. They talked, and they talked, and they talked, and it got to a point where the conversation itself proved so long and lively that it was impossible to contain it into one show. Their conversation, rooted in a protracted faith, became itself protracted. And I'm not sure what this says about the nature of this program or the quality of these two men, both from other locations, both ending up in New York City for entirely different reasons and through entirely different existential trajectories. But it is believed that you, dear listener, will find a comparable faith if you listen to this program. This being part one of a two-part conversation, as well as the installment that follows. The topic of faith apparently requires bifurcation, and it begins with the apparent start of this multifaceted conversation. Enjoy. Okay, so I am here with Hari Kunzru, who's most recently the author of Gods Without Men. Hari, how are you doing?
Doing very well, actually. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to meet you finally. I wanted to first of all start off on a question of faith, predictably enough. A writer has a lot of faith when he is putting together a novel. A reader, places her hard-earned shekels over the counter, has faith in the writer to tell a story. The characters in this novel, Gods Without Men, they are both faithful and faithless to ideologies, to their families, to their relationships. So faith is a very loaded concept, and I'm curious why any novelist would tackle something that is so tricky, so duplicitous, so hypocritical, so difficult to pin down. I mean, how do you deal with this? Because even though this novel does not always answer all questions, you are dealing with something that, well, you have to fit it into narrative. So just to start off here, maybe we can start there.
I mean, I suppose my own relationship to faith is a complex one.
Yes.
You know, I've got an Indian father from a Hindu background. Many people on both sides of my family are actively practicing religious. My mother's background is Protestant English. My parents decided quite sensibly to bring me up without any religious, not to bring me up in either of those two traditions. So I was kind of left to find my own way. And I've always had, for many reasons, a kind of inclination to see things one way and then see things another way. But you know, over the years, I've kind of developed a sense that I don't believe in God. I am an atheist, and however, I don't think that that position, the idea that you don't believe in some kind of a personalized creator to whom you owe an ethical duty not to sleep with the wrong people, that doesn't really kind of take any of the big questions off the table about human agency, about ethics, about meaning and value. And I've always been very fascinated by people of faith, because in some ways I find them very scary.
Yeah.
People with a very strong faith have stopped asking questions at a certain point. There's a certain point where, you know, they have made this leap, this extraordinary leap into the world of faith. And it's something that I felt I understood poorly as well. I think the only book that's ever really kind of made me really kind of feel what it must be like to have a powerful religious faith is Fear and Trembling, the Kierkegaard book, where he talks about the extraordinary moment where Abraham has to sacrifice Isaac, and he is prepared to do this because of his faith that God's word is true, and to be able to do, I mean, that something that encapsulates it. I mean, it's a terrifying act, it's a horrific act, and it's, you know, and it's in a way echoes with all these incredibly violent things that have happened in the name of religion. But at the same time, there's a horror to it, there's a sublimity to it, there's an absolute abandonment of the human, and this novel is a way, is my attempt to talk about our relationship with the unknowable and with the unknown. And it's about all sorts of people who have many different kind of ways of conceptualizing this and many different sort of solutions that they come up with. But the central question is the question of absence and unknowability. At a certain point, human comprehension ends. You know, and whether you believe that ultimately everything is potentially knowable, like Jazz, the husband in this husband and wife couple who are at the center of the book, you know, Jazz is a rational man. He's trained as a scientist. His sense of the world is that if you think hard enough and you have the right concepts and you test and you hypothesize, you know, the world will open up its secrets. And his wife goes absolutely the other way. I mean, she withdraws into a kind of mysticism, and other characters in the novel range from, you know, various people who have profound faith, like a Franciscan friar and a lapsed Mormon silver miner, you know, to people who have kind of a much more complicated relationship with it and a skeptical relationship with it.
But I would argue that this concern for faith, both sides of the fence, I suppose almost mimicking Fitzgerald's idea of the first class intellectual could hold two opposing ideas in his mind. I mean, with Jazz and Lisa, it's very interesting, those sections in particular, because the prose itself is both general but specific enough for us to get an idea. It's almost as if the prose needs to mimic their special judgment towards the world, towards each other, and the like. And I'm curious, you know, how you developed this at the prose level, because that was one thing that I think really impressed me about your book. And what struggles were there to get that balance? I'm just curious.
You mean in terms of voice for the different
characters? Yes, exactly. Especially for Jazz and Lisa, yes.
You know, it's one of these kind of things that emerges through the doing. I don't think it was a very programmatic thing. I mean, those characters emerged as quite kind of defined opposites to each other in their reaction to what happens to their missing child. I'm interested in the business of faith in the financial markets, and yes, the idea of faith in credit and the extraordinary kind of high wire act that is the global financial system, which depends on everybody believing that this money exists. And yet, you know, so placing a kind of Mr. Science in this world of high finance was an interesting one. So he out of those decisions, his way of talking and his way of understanding the world emerged quite naturally. You know, once you know that somebody has a higher degree in physics, you know, they're unlikely to be basing their worldview on the Celestine prophecy. And Lisa's character comes out of something that I've observed from a lot of sort of liberals with humanities backgrounds here in London and everywhere. And that actually, I mean, people aren't very scientifically educated very often, and actually have a kind of gut hostility to the procedures of science, because they feel that it's kind of closing down the space of wonder in the world. And that leads quite a lot of people. I'm always quite surprised by people who are, you know, very skeptical, argumentative, you know, will often have this kind of blind spot where it comes to especially things to do with health in particular, like, you know, people get into homeopathy and various other things that I personally consider quackery, because partly they wish to believe a certain set of things about the world that have to do with wonder and ineffability and unknowability and often beauty and a kind of non-utilitarian way of seeing the world. So all kind of very valid reasons to want to protect a kind of sacred space from intrusion by the methodology of science, but it kind of can lead people into some very, very strange kind of almost sort of anti-rational positions, and those two kind of ways of being can be very buried in people, because we don't tend to have these conversations, you know. Yeah. It's off the list of what's polite dinner party chat.
Oh, and be and polite I was as you a, like here.
Well, we can talk about it, but having a couple who basically have a great deal in common, who love each other, they genuinely love each other, these two, but the kind of gradual exposure of the kind of the real contours of their ways of dealing with the unknown is what causes this terrible tension in their relationship. And that seemed to me to speak to quite an interesting fault line that, you know, runs across a lot of contemporary culture.
Yeah. I'm wondering if Lisa was, at least in relation to the question of faith, almost sort of a spillover character for what you could not do with Dawn, who I'm also really curious about. I mean, it's interesting that the women tend to gravitate towards these, you know, towards issues of, like, blind faith, often destructive faith. Mm. I mean, the whole... I mean, with Lisa, it's interesting, too, because you have all these media incursions into her life, so yeah. It's almost like some part of the world wishes to punish her for her beliefs.
I am very interested in the way that the media presents women, especially yeah. mothers, and the kind of the censoriousness that attaches itself to women's choices around motherhood and around work and so on. I mean, in this novel, their child disappears, they become the object of this media witch hunt, and everybody zeroes in on, is this a bad mother? Is this a cold mother? You know, she emotes in a way, she fails to emote in a way that the media folk think is appropriate. And hence, she's immediately suspect. And yet, you know, because it's a novel and you can get inside somebody's inner life, you know, we know very well that she's absolutely destroyed by this. And she's, you know, she's an emotional person and she has, you know, she's not some kind of psychopath who fails to have correct emotional response. And however, the appearance sort of drifts further and further from reality. I mean, of course, they're also New Yorkers. Look, you know, lost out west, yeah. really. So there's, you know, everyone hates New Yorkers and the rest of the country, as far as I can see. Since I'm now get identified as a New Yorker by other Americans in other parts, the English accent kind of gets bracketed into some sort of New Yorker thing. So yeah. I get the prejudice.
Those
as well.
Wild and crazy liberals, are, yeah. their British accents, and
yeah, exactly.
You're drinking a cappuccino right now, so there
with,
you go.
Drinking a cappuccino yeah. with a British accent yeah. is exactly what everyone thinks happens
you are
in
America's
Chelsea.
I am.
Rick Santorum right now is burning an effigy of me, you know, okay. in a basement somewhere in Idaho. I guess Dawn was the other good character yeah. we were going to talk about. So Dawn is the motel owner, and she's a working class woman from this small Eastern California desert town, and she's been really knocked about by life, and she wanted to get out of the very kind of narrow set of possibilities that were offered to her as a teenager, and ended up joining this cult that was out at the rocks near her town. And this, you know, the book follows her story, where as this very hopeful kind of moment of transcendence, you know, her wish for community, her wish to be part of something that felt more magical and more filled with possibility than her ordinary life. It follows how that kind of curdles, and the kind of coercive aspects of being in a group living situation take over, and you know, this sexual exploitation, and eventually she's yeah. basically put out on the street in LA to make money for to keep things running back at the cult HQ, and you know, that precipitates sort of lost, you know, 20 lost years, but she pulls her life back together, and you know, she's managed to salvage a situation where she has a business, and she has a kind of she's in a way the kind of keeper of the knowledge in this book. She yeah. kind of, she knows how it goes on the dark side. She has hints of the long history of this place that is kind of told in fragments through the novel. And so when the Jazz and Lisa and their little boy Raj come and book a room at the motel, we know that they're entering a kind of world that she has a far, far greater understanding of. And she also, you know, Jazz and Lisa's relationship problems are fairly kind of vanilla in Dawn's world, where she's, you know, yeah. she's seen people do much, much more terrible things.
But you also have Dawn accuse at least two men in this novel of sexually abusing a child. And that I thought was kind of odd. And I was yeah. like, why is Harry, like, you know, so into this whole pederasty charge sort of situation? I mean, that was very odd.
It's kind of, I'm very interested in, you know, in offense and in the you know, what the unspeakable, yeah. really, like, and what happens when people are faced with the unspeakable. And I've done, you know, my work as a journalist and as a kind of free speech advocate, it's become very clear that there are two things that you can kind of put into any conversation that will shut it down almost completely, and will make most people almost instantly call for whatever draconian regulation is, you know, is under discussion, and it's terrorism and paedophilia. You know, as soon as you say you're helping the terrorists, you're helping the pedophiles, 99% of people will say, you know, we'll press the button on whatever you're proposing, whether that, you know, however horrific, however, and the kind of the construction of sexuality around children has changed during my lifetime. It's been very interesting that things that just weren't kind of visible. I mean, yeah. Clearly, there was a lot of pedophilia happening, you know, when I was a kid. But you were kind of, you almost advised more, I remember, like, to be on the lookout. It was your job as a kid to protect yourself. Don't go with that man. Don't you know, put yourself in a situation where you're alone with such a person. Whereas now, with the kind of public discussion around it, I mean, for the purposes of the book, the figure of a child, you know, and all the kind of the emotional things that we attach to a child, you know, ideas about purity, ideas of hope, and all these kind of things, are quite important in lots of the sort of the kind of rather undeveloped metaphorical resonances. You know, it's a book that I've tried to organize not around sort of straightforward plot all the time, but around kind of, I mean, I call them rhymes or echoes between and missing children and absent children, and kind of sort of almost spiritual or sublime children, you know, pop up all over the place in this book. And so it kind of, I mean, until you pointed it out, I hadn't really thought about it, but it seems kind of natural that there would also be the notion of, you know, abuse and kidnap and that kind of thing as a kind of counterweight to this sort of sublimity. Mm-hmm.
Well, I also wanted to ask about the simulacra, many of them throughout this book. You have Walter, the financial model. You have, there's a number of things. I mean, the reenactment that Layla undergoes, the sort of Stratfor-like Blue Four, which reminded me very much of Tom McCarthy's Remainder. You have the considerable media incursions into Lisa, which I suggested earlier. All these allusions are housed within one giant illusion. And I'm wondering, you know, how does breaking one ginormous illusion into several tinier ones, I mean, what does this do to promote a relationship with the author and the reader into these many issues of faith? I mean, how does splintering and compartmentalizing do this?
I mean, I always think of these kind of as the sort of gaps between the slabs of story in this, you know, the shards or the fragments of story in this book is kind of gaps that the reader falls into and is left to kind of deal with without, you know, it's quite deliberately, you know, I mean, it's a sort of breaking of the contract between the writer and the reader, because, you know, the writer's supposed to say, tell your story. If I say something is in this, it's going to be important and you should pay attention to it. And I promise you there'll be a, you know, all will be revealed in the end. And so that kind of enactment of you know, I mean, a very, very deliberate refusal to tie up certain ends is kind of quite important to the what I'm trying to do in this book, which is to just sort of, you know, inch my way around this idea of the unknowable and the unsayable. And the simulacra thing, you know, it's really kind of just very sort of deep in my, or on the surface in my, way of seeing the world. Like, you know, I as you did, we've all grown up in this sort of period of postmodernism, which I would kind of be slightly controversially contend is over now. But there was, you know, there was this sort of 60s, 70s, 80s interest in the world as a sort of sign shifting over sign, and a kind of series of interlocking illusions that might not have been generated by capital in order to kind of distract us from the real. And, you know, I think a lot of that analysis is pretty good. But in itself, those kind of postmodern fictional ploys of saying, see, there's nothing under my words, you know, there's no referent, there's no depth here. You know, we know that now. You know, that's just in our way of kind of being in the world. And actually, we are in a period of kind of overlays. You know, I'm very, very interested in the moment in augmented reality and the idea that you'll be able to quite soon kind of almost be able to use your sort of phone as a sort of window through which to kind of overlay information onto the world. But I think we already have a lot of overlays, and you know,
augmented reality we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And clearly, something like a war simulation, one desert overlaid into another desert. You know, I think the Iraq war Iraq is the kind of site of America dealing with its own current version of itself. You know, I mean, everybody has got an imagination of this desert far away where stuff is happening that is incredibly important and over which we have very little control. And the idea that you know, you've got one desert overlaid against the other, and then these simulations actually are taking place. I mean, that's not a fictional thing. And then when you are out near 29 Palms, you do occasionally see women in hijab because they're kind of workers from these simulations. And then you just get that moment of, where am I? You know, is that, you know, am I in the US or am I in the kind of imagination of the US? Am I in the war movie imagination of the US?
Or are you in a gap?
Or am I in some sort of gap between the two? And the business of modeling more generally. Now, Walter, the financial model, is more or less explicitly for his creator, Jazz's boss, Cy Bachman. The model is more or less explicitly a kind of mystical tool. He is attempting to restore the fragments of the broken world. He's a catalyst and is sifting through the shards and fragments, looking for the one kind of fragment of the Sephiroth that were the kind of original material of the creation, and the. Simulation and modeling form an increasingly important part of the ways that we're kind of working with the world. In any kind of system that's too complex for you to be able to kind of model it from kind of the ground up, just to sort of to say, you know, specify a set of equations and be able to kind of, you know, predict it all the outcomes. You know, a lot of things like markets, like weather, like you know, any complex system like that, are only really amenable to being understood through making a model and seeing how the model runs. And these models are now being hooked up to trading engines and trading against each other in the marketplace. You know, the market is becoming something that is only very partially human and is operating at timescales that are no longer human timescales, which is a very odd breach of what the market was supposed to do. You know, I mean, a market is supposed to allow us to organize production through giving us price signals. You know, soap is really expensive over in Chicago because there's a shortage of soap, make more soap, the price comes down.
Yeah.
But that's how a market works. When a high-speed trading engine is executing 10,000 trades a second, and is splitting its trades up in such a way as to try and disguise its position in the market from other analysts, human and machine, you get into situations where groups of machines are beginning to react to each other and get and second guess each other. And there was this thing, the flash crash, a couple of years ago. And these flash crashes are actually now, small ones, are happening on a weekly basis. There's an incredible volatility going on, and the market has kind of gone away from its original human purpose into being this rather kind of self-organized sort of engine, at which we are simultaneously told is the absolute indicator of all human value. You know, that the market is the answer, say the market fundamentalists, to, you know, almost any question you want to throw at it. You know, what kind of books do we want to read? Ask the fucking market.
Yeah.
And, you know, this business of modeling and simulation in a world where people are running simulations in order to try and kind of intuit what the world might be like.
But I'm tempted to accuse you of the same charge, because that's essentially what you're doing.
Well, it's what a lot of novelists do. In fact, I'd say. Maybe that's quite a good job for the novel in the current world. As to, I mean, the old-fashioned, you know, virtues of the novel, its kind of expansiveness, its ability to bring kind of lots of different worlds together, and the ability to kind of place the reader into situations which are foreign to the reader. These are all really useful kind of simulation type tools. You know, the novel's like a kind of exoskeleton that you can kind of strap on, and then you suddenly find yourself in another place, in another body, have another set of experiences. And you know, if that's what it turned out to be, if it turned out to be a kind of, you know, the novelist, a simulator, I'd take that. I think it's a useful role to play.
Dayton, there's something that is almost sad and predatory about this guy who's going around collecting stories at this Indian reservation. And it leads me to ask about another conundrum that may be related to this idea of running models that you may face as a writer. I mean, there is this incident in the Schmidt chapter early on where he ties Lizzie's neck to the back of a truck and then goes for a half a mile dragging her like this. And this seems very close to me to Theron Wayne Johnson, who did the exact same thing about maybe a year or two ago. And it leads me to ask you, because I do follow you on Twitter. I know you keep tabs on a lot of different stories. Do you have any moral duty to, I suppose, when you take a story possibly from the headlines and you put it into fiction, I mean, you know, is there any sort of part of you that feels compelled to be ethically transformative of the story so it becomes yours?
I mean, that is interesting. I mean, actually, the headline you're talking about, I've not heard of. That story was told to me in a bar in 29 Palms, in fact, by a guy who it was his, he did that.
Yeah.
And he told it to me that it was his, he was shotgun wedding, very young guy, and he'd married this, I think it was in Alaska. I don't remember the place that he actually had been in. You know, he'd been working in, I think he'd been working in the oil fields.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the marriage didn't work out, and I got drunk, and I tied her to the back of my truck, and I, you know, and he told this as a funny story.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most chilling, and it was very strange just to hear this guy be flippant about it. And he clearly, you know, his compulsion to tell a complete stranger about it, he was an old guy, you know, 50 years on in a bar, meant that this is obviously, you know, it was a serious thing for him, and he, you know, that on some level he understood what a horrific thing it was. But his macho kind of, she didn't look the same after, kind of thing was terrifying. And I did take his story and give it to Schmidt, and because my sense of a lot of these guys who do go out to the desert is that there's something they need to be away from.
Yeah.
And that's usually the eyes of other people and the judgment of other people. You know, people often seem to have turned up there because of they've done something wrong. But the question you asked is this question of, you know, the ethical duty to your research. You know, I mean, I think that's certainly one thing that leads me not to tend to do formal interviews and stuff as part of a research for a novel. Like the last book I wrote, My Revolutions, was very, very closely researched. I was trying to find out the stories of people from the 60s and 70s who had, for one reason or another, decided to use violence in support of their politics. And there are a bunch of people who are around who I could have conceivably phone an interview. But then at that point, you do get to the thing of like, well, if somebody's given you an interview and you're going to make them, you know, you're going to change material to suit your story, then I think you are... In a problematic space. And, and what happened to me with that book was I was involved with a piece of a sort of activist thing. There was a bunch of long story. It was a sort of anti-gentrification action in my neighborhood in London, where some people had barricaded themselves into a cafe, Greasy Spoon cafe. And it became this kind of siege situation that lasted for 6 months. The new owner of this cafe was going to tear it down and build a mini mall. And it had been a kind of place that was very kind of pivotal to the local community. And it was a kind of point of where people were trying to ask, this East End community was being very rapidly hollowed out by gentrification. And a kind of quite a weird alliance of people ranging from sort of boho gentrifiers like me, due to, you know, people from the local estate and kind of some of the sort of street people and various sort of activists from the old school activists from East London, all kind of popped up to try and kind of make this thing work. And it became a media story and blah, blah, blah. But, and so, you know, the, it, this cafe turned into a kind of bunker thing, you know, because people are expecting violent eviction at any moment, and bailiffs and bulldozers and the whole lot. You know, there's metal doors and a sort of bunker atmosphere inside. And so we'd spend evenings in there, you know, you imagine a freezing London, sort of damp winter, with the kind of gas fire going and kind of eating beans out of a pan. And I talked to this guy, John, who was in his 60s, and he seemed, you know, a pretty sound guy, seemed to know a lot about left theory and blah, blah, blah. And then another friend, David, said, you know, you should talk to John for your book. And put it together that I had actually been spending my days researching his biography, that he turned out to be this guy who had done a 10-year prison sentence for being part of the Angry Brigade.
Yeah.
You know, British, badly named British terrorist group. And yet, so there I was left with a situation where this guy was obviously, you know, it was almost his story that I was wanting to tell, like what, you know, what had led somebody like him. He dropped out of Cambridge, he'd torn his finals papers up as a protest, walked out of his finals and headed into the sort of squat scene in London. And I already kind of knew him, and there was in this sort of situation where if I pumped him for information without declaring why I wanted it, that would be unethical. If I formally asked him for an interview, I would then be obligated to tell his... And he's never spoken to the press, and he'd never spoken... You know, he'd not made public statements. And so in the end, I had to settle for really scrupulously not speaking to him about anything to do with the old days at all.
Wow.
And I did that, wrote the book, took him for a drink and said, all right, this is what I've done, this is what I've been working on, I hope you appreciate that I've not attempted to pump you for any information at all.
Yeah.
I'd give you a manuscript if you want, and you know, read it, don't read it. And that turned out to be the right thing to do. You know, he ended up actually, he was one of several people convicted of terrorist offences who were at my launch in London for that book. But he ended up agreeing to actually speak for the first time on a public platform. I got him and Bill Ayers from the Weather Underground to have a stage conversation in London.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was really, really interesting.
Yeah,
Bill Ayers...
Is that online anywhere?
It's not. I think ICA might have it archived somewhere.
That sounds like a fascinating conversation.
It was really interesting because Bill Ayers is, you know, he's a professor now.
Yep.
You know, he was underground for a few years, but he was never charged. He never did any prison time. And for him, it's pretty romantic what happened. Whereas John served lots of prison time. You know, he said a decade in prison, and he, you know, couldn't find decent work afterwards. You know, he was... And John is still very committed to the politics, which actually, you know, which he espoused as a 21-year-old. You know, he's still fighting that fight, and Bill has kind of moved on.
Yeah.
And the whole ways they spoke about commitment and the kind of consequences of their action were thoroughly different. It was really, really telling. Like, and it's that kind of, you know, the chips fall one way for one person, another way for another person, and you know, chance is a big element of that, you know.
So if you can't take a potential subject of your research out for a drink, what do you do?
I think you use what's in the public domain, and I think there's you know, novelists have always done research, but there's been a bit of a kind of an older generation of novelists, I think, will be a bit coy about it usually, because there's this notion that, you know, it's got to be creation ex nihilo, and it's got to be this kind of wonderful effulgence from your own mind. But everybody knows now that, you know, we copy and paste.
Yeah.
You know, we're making stuff out of the world around us, and that's a kind of, you know, it's very well understood as a sort of legitimate and creative action, you know, by people of our sort of generation. And so I don't have a problem saying that, you know, yeah, there are elements of this novel that I have, you know, found, you know, and there are stories that I have altered. And I, you know, I think nobody is close enough to a real character that I could be accused of misrepresenting anybody's real life. Other than Fray Garces, the 18th century Franciscan who existed, who I've given the same name, the same journey to, and I have very precisely, and I pointed out in a note at the end of the book that I've added this kind of missing 2 weeks.
So, yeah.
You know, I've placed a gap in a narrative where in reality there's no gap.
So basically, you really don't have any duty to these people, unless, of course, they're alive, and unless, of course, they're friends of yours. I mean,
well, no, I mean, I think you know,
dead might actually help. You know,
right? I mean, obviously, I mean, there are endless novels now about. I mean, even living people. There's that Laura Bush novel, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And I mean, that I would find a kind of complex project, but I think the kind of, you know, when you're talking about constructing character, and when you're talking about especially attempting to construct sort of systems of characters in, you know, in a big sort of social space, like a novel.
Yeah.
You know, often, you know, you do find yourself impinging on things that are the, you know, that are a kind of public, the public persona of people. And this, you know, our attitude towards this has changed completely. I interviewed Robert Coover recently, and I don't know if you know his novel, The Public Burning.
I do know. In fact, and I mentioned it in relation to Kim Jong-il with Adam Johnson.
Oh, okay. Well,
who's the greater fabricator here?
Yeah, so he told me that as a project that was so terrifying to his publisher that they almost refused to put it out. Then they, you know, they put him through a lot of legal stuff, a lot of changes, and then he believes that actually the book was then killed by, I mean, the book was put out and then went onto the bestseller list, and then the next week was withdrawn from sale. There was no more stock given to bookshops, and he believes that actually pressure was put on the publisher by people in the close to Nixon.
Yeah.
And yet, routinely now, and that book is a very, as you know, is a very fantastical, unlikely, but nobody is going to really feel that the tricky dick in that book is identical to the historical Richard Nixon. You know, he's a kind of projection of Nixonianism and that kind of aspect of American politics at that time. And yet, you know, people will pretty much do sort of biopic-like kind of, you know, faux realist stuff about living figures now and not run into the same sort of legal trouble. And I think that's a very interesting shift. You know, we're in a moment where people are very head up about memoir.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even James Frey turns out not to have taken all the drugs that he, you know, he claims he took. And, you know, he has to go to prostrate himself in front of Oprah, our secular sort of popess.
Yes.
And, you know, he has to say sorry for lying, Mrs. Oprah. And people feel somehow shortchanged about that. But, I mean, novel and nonfiction are, you know, getting much more kind of weirdly entangled. And I think that's an interesting thing. You know, I mean, I think that's partly just because we're more sophisticated as readers. We understand, you know, we live in everything's Googleable. You know, you see something that, you know, on a page that reminds you of something, you can put that search string into Google and you can pretty much find out if it's, you know, comes from another place. It's like kind of auto T.S. Eliot is a...
So a novel is sort of almost a link dump for you, comparable to your Twitter account.
I'd like that in a way. It would be wonderful to imagine. I mean, I have two contradictory feelings about that, really. On one side is that I like the notion of sort of bleed out from the work into the world.
Yes.
And I like the idea that in some ways you could be able to drop through into kind of greater depth in the stuff that interested you and not in other places. But then the other thing is that the contradictory feeling is that the novel is a bounded work. You know, it's a very deliberate carving of a space out of the flow of info, or the flow of stuff that we have, and it is that act of choice and the act of saying this is in it and this is not in it that makes it interesting to read as a novel, as a work. You know, people say, oh, the novel's dead, it's a perversely old 18th century form, why write novels now, we should all be doing hyperlinked online writing that we see in 3D with goggles.
Back to Coover,
and then he's, but interestingly, he, you know, he does all this kind of 3D cave writing with his students and then doesn't do it himself. You know, I mean, he's very interested in algorithmic processes and fable and non-original kind of writing, and at the same time he sticks his name on the books, and it's in each one is a considered project and is a work, and there's value in that and there's importance in that as a gesture, and I don't think that's going to go away. You know, however however seamlessly wired our experience of language becomes, I think it's that act of pulling the fish out of the river.
Yeah.
Pretty much is what we're doing, and kind of, you know, drawing an artificial boundary, which we know is artificial and arbitrary, blah blah blah. That's an artistic act.
This is the end of part one of this conversation.
With part two beckoning just around the corner, which gets into issues of genre, esoteric personal anecdotes involving technology, and more
of this notion of the ineffable will be coming in a matter of days. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening. Have faith.